You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now it is time for Dear Science. We are joined in the studio by AUT's Professor Alan Blackman. How are you doing today, Alan?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Shamina.
That is awesome. So to start off with today, we're talking about something that's been in the news quite a lot lately, the death of the North Korean leader's estranged half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, or more specifically about the lethal chemical that was used to kill him. So tell us a bit more about this.
Well, it really was quite horrifying when you saw it on TV that all it took was this woman coming up behind him and dabbing his face with something, and he was dead 15 minutes later. And as was found out by the Malaysian authorities after that, he was killed by a nerve agent called VX, which some people call nerve gas. It's not really a gas, but a nerve agent is a better name for it. And what this does is that it disrupts the nerve impulses in the body. So our nerves are sort of firing, and as a result of that, our muscles do what we want them to do, etc., etc. And that's all due to a molecule called acetylcholine. And this molecule essentially delivers the sort of the electrical stimulus between the nerve cells and the muscle cells. And so every time a nerve cell fires, to use the terminology, you get a molecule of acetylcholine that delivers this signal to the muscles. Mm-hmm. And then after it's done that, it gets destroyed by an enzyme which is called acetylcholinesterase, mm-hmm. which is a mouthful. And so it requires that, because if this molecule didn't get destroyed, then it would just keep sending signals to the muscles, and the muscles would keep contracting or doing whatever they're doing without end, okay? Mm-hmm. So this acetylcholinesterase enzyme is critical to the functioning of your muscles. Now, nerve agents were first developed by, in fact, Germans just before the Second World War, and they were actually made in quite large quantities in World War II, but thankfully they were not used. So two in particular called Tabin and Sarin. Those were the original nerve agents. And they're both based on phosphate, which is a ubiquitous chemical entity, shall we call it, in the body. And so after the war, it was found that the Germans were doing this sort of stuff. And so obviously people got interested in developing more nerve agents. And the British sort of in the early 50s and the Americans got into this, and they developed a series of nerve agents called the V agents, of which VX was one. And the VX agent was the one that killed Kim Jong-nam. Mm-hmm. And the way that it does this is that it stops this enzyme working, this acetylcholinesterase enzyme. So it inhibits it. It's called an inhibitor. It stops it working. And if it stops working, then this acetylcholine molecule hangs around and it starts delivering persistent messages to the muscles. And then the muscles go into spasm. They can't stop contracting. And then you're in deep doo-doo, okay? Uh-huh. And the way that death normally occurs is through respiratory paralysis, because the muscles involved in breathing, etc., they're just spasming the whole time, and that's that. And it's all over Red Rover sort of thing. So these sorts of molecules used in snake venom, that's one of the things that kills you if you get bitten by particular types of snakes, mm-hmm. these acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. The original nerve agents developed by the Germans were pretty toxic, so it only took sort of a couple of grams on the skin as a fatal dose. This VX, it takes about 10 milligrams on the skin as a fatal dose. So what people are thinking is that if you've seen the TV footage, there's no way that the woman who delivered the stuff would have got out of it alive if the stuff that she had on her rag or whatever that she got on the face with was actual VX. So people are speculating that what they did was had the two components that make up VX essentially in a separate mixture, and then they mixed together on his face and formed the VX agent.
Okay.
And because otherwise she would have been dead.
Yeah, so, right, from even having like any sort of contact.
Yes,
with
indeed.
It.
Oh, yeah, any contact, any inhalation, you know, it's so, 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 so highly, highly toxic. And very, very nasty stuff. So that's kind of the way it works. It's, you know, it's a rather insidious thing.
Super ruthless. Yeah.
Well, they were originally
on a mission.
They originally developed sort of as insecticides, but then they found they were actually too toxic to be insecticides.
Right, and they kill humans as well.
Yeah, that's when the army gets involved and interested in stuff. So
using things as weapons.
Yes. Yeah. So that's sort of the brief history of this nerve agent, or one of these particular nerve agents, but very, very, very toxic materials. And and it's horrendous to think that certain rogue states in the world, who should remain nameless, have got access to this sort of stuff and are willing to use it outside their borders.
And also, well, because I feel like sarin gas has been something that's come up a lot in the news as well, so that kind of has the same, you mentioned sarin before.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yep. So that's different to the one that was used in this death, but has the same function.
It does, yeah. It was used way back in the 90s, you might remember, and there was a Tokyo subway attack by the Aum Shinriko sect, where they released a whole bunch of sarin on the tubes in Tokyo, and I think sort of a dozen or so people died there. And they also used VX as well in sort of specific attacks on three people. So, of course, if you know anything about chemistry and you've got a lab, then you can make these sorts of things, sadly. And, as I say, it is... obviously, these things are banned now. You're not allowed to make or store more than 100 grams, I think, is the limit. And that's only for sort of investigations and whatever they do with these sorts of things. But, perhaps the North Koreans are making it on bulk scale and everything. Yeah, it's just a scary thought, really.
And so would Kim Jong-nam, would he have been in any pain going through this process? Pretty significantly?
Perhaps not the pain, but the distress, I imagine, when you find that you can't breathe.
Reason to panic a little.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
But other than that, like...
Oh, you're probably asking the wrong person on that. I hope never to know.
True. I mean, I guess the death time, though, you said it was very rapid.
Yes,
it's like 15 minutes.
Yeah,
it's not sort of like days of being like, you know, your body like slowly sort of starts to shut down. It's quite a rapid process.
Yes, yeah, indeed. So,
over and done with quick? I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. On that morbid note, we will move on to our next thing. We're talking about NASA's recent discovery of 7 Earth-sized worlds orbiting a nearby star, which is beyond our immediate solar system.
Indeed. Okay, so everyone's always speculated since time immemorial, you know, that there might be life or might not elsewhere in the universe. And obviously, if there is life in the universe, it's got to exist on planets. And for the longest time, we were unable to figure out whether there are any planets elsewhere in the universe. What we can see, obviously, is stars. That's what you see when you look up at night. Planets obviously don't glow like stars do because they're not as hot. So therefore, it's going to be difficult for us to see those, again, because stars are so far away, etc., etc. However, in 1992, there was the first report of what is called an exoplanet, and that's a planet outside our solar system.
Mm.
And the ability to detect these things has come with the amazing advances that we've had in sort of massive telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope, these very large array telescopes where they have a whole bunch of things on sort of opposite sides of the world, and it's, you know, just extraordinary the advances they've been able to make. And so basically one of the ways that they can detect these things now is they look at a particular star and they can see the planets orbiting the star as it goes around it, as it comes in front of it, between the star and the Earth. They can see a very, very, very slight loss of intensity of the star, which then gets regained as the other planet goes around it. So that's one of the ways that they can do these sorts of things. There's other ways that use things with the Doppler effect and stuff like that, but we don't necessarily have to get into that. But this particular star, which is called TRAPPIST-1, and this is about 40 light years away from Earth. It's extraordinarily dim, number one. Okay, it's what is commonly called a red dwarf, and you can't see it with the naked eye. You can't really even see it with binoculars. You need a honking great telescope to even be able to begin to see this thing, which makes the discovery even more remarkable, because you're relying on the sunlight to be able to see these things, or the starlight to be able to see these things. And so they have now found that this tiny red dwarf, which is only about 10% of the diameter of the sun, or the radius, sorry, of the sun, has got seven Earth-sized planets orbiting around it. Now, how the heck they can figure that out is beyond me, but, you know, it's quite extraordinary that they can do this.
To, like, distinguish one from the other, yeah, if they're all Earth-sized.
Yeah, and to actually see them and to figure out their rotation periods around the star. So the rotation periods are much, much quicker than the solar system. So all seven planets go around this star in a time between 1 and 20 days. So they're really, they're really whizzing around it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, of course, they're much, much closer to the actual star than, say, the Earth is to the sun. Much, much closer. So looking at the luminosity of the star, they can figure out the temperature of it. Looking at the distance from the planets from that particular star, they can figure out what the conditions might be like on those planets in terms of temperature, etc., etc. And they've figured out that three of those planets exist in what is called the habitable zone, which then means that liquid water can exist on the surface of the planet, which is, as we know it anyway, a prerequisite for life.
Yeah.
And so therefore, these three planets would be good candidates possibly for, you know, the existence of life. And obviously that is going to be speculation for years and decades and maybe centuries to come. I don't know. But it's somewhere to start anyway. And so this is the biggest exoplanet collection that has been found thus far. So it was a really, really big deal. NASA held a press conference last Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
You know, announced it to the world. And they announced it as it was published in Nature, so it was embargoed. And so Nature is the biggest science magazine on the planet, and so that's where they published it. So it must be right, and we hope anyway.
But probably you can assume it's been peer-reviewed and a few other people have read over this.
Yep, absolutely. That's the way that good science works. So, yes.
Awesome. And so you said that there are also other exoplanets that have been discovered. Yes. What are those ones?
So there's around about, looking it up this morning, over about 3,500 exoplanets that are now known.
Whoa.
So, yeah, yeah. So all the way from 1992 when the first one was discovered.
Yeah.
And I guess in the early days you could only see really, really big exoplanets, so things the size of Jupiter and stuff like that,
right? Yeah,
or you know, or even larger than that. But now we've got down
because
to the
of
point,
the microscopes.
Yeah. So so now you can, we've got to the point where you can detect sort of Earth-sized planets, and that's the sort of thing that, you know, we're perhaps looking for. And you're looking for them being in the correct vicinity relative to their star, so that life could potentially occur on them. So liquid water is the big thing. So you know, from these experiments that they've done, these observations that they've made, you know, they can figure out all this stuff. They can figure out the temperatures and the possible habitats, I guess,
just from a microscope,
just from the telescope.
Oh, yeah, sorry, telescope. I keep saying microscope. Yeah. Telescope.
Well,
is what I mean.
Very, very fancy telescope.
Yes,
so not just looking necessarily just at light itself, but looking also in the infrared, looking in the ultraviolet, X-rays, etc. All the whole gamut, the whole spectrum.
Yeah. So they can just gauge all of that from a telescope.
Yeah,
that's
and
amazing.
It really is quite extraordinary what they're doing. Absolutely amazing.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
So just to finish off, we've got kind of a gross story about Subway chicken sandwiches.
Yes, yes. We better be quick on this one. I've got to run away.
Oh,
from
yeah,
lecture,
yeah, yeah.
But
so just talk us through this.
Well, in Canada, they did a study of chicken that is served at fast food outlets. So they went to five different fast food companies. So your Macca's and your Subway's and all of those sorts of things. And what they did was they analysed the DNA in the chicken that was served in these places in Canada. And four out of the five, the DNA found in the chicken was at least 90% chicken DNA, which you'd hope. Because, you know, if it's pure chicken, it should be 100% chicken DNA.
Most definitely, yes.
And when they went to Subway and analysed their chicken there, they found that it was between about 48 and 52% chicken DNA.
Ooh. What else? So what else was in it then?
Well, that's the weird thing, because they reckon that the rest of the DNA that they found in that was soy DNA.
Okay.
Which seems...
it's not really what you're paying for, right?
Well, it's not, and I'd be amazed if you could get 50% soy into chicken. It just seems too much. You know, again, people are speculating that the experiment might not have been done properly.
Okay.
or that, you know, it might be something like turkey maybe, which is cheaper than chicken, and, right, you know, all that sort of stuff. But so just to emphasize, this is only in Canada.
Okay, yeah, right.
And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes of this. So it's just sort of hit the news sort of in the last day or two. And
has Subway responded yet?
Yeah, they have. They said that they obviously don't believe the results. And so they're going to have a look at these, okay, as you would hope that they would.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it does seem a little bit, for want of a better word, fishy.
That, chicken-y.
Yeah, that these sort of results will come out. So I don't know what's going on. Perhaps watch the space, maybe.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. But also, like, these things are great, though, because they, like, research like this, then they force big corporations, indeed, to be like, oh, you know what, we probably can't really sell people sandwiches that are 50% chicken when actually they're advertised as being chicken breast, so maybe we, yes, should change that. So yep, it's good that this information comes out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree. Yep.
Keep but them, also keep a little bit icky. Yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for coming back again this week, Alan.
Not a problem, Shamina.
We'll see you again next week.
Will do. Thanks.
All right, bye.
Okay, see ya.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.